fiddle with the computer a little bit. We're going to get this underway. I'd like to start by introducing Ed Niehaus. I think you probably know Ed for a long period of time that he has been involved with the Foresight back when he had one of the top PR firms around. Now he is with Cypress Ventures, PR to venture capital. That's a great transition. We'll have to hear somehow how you made that move. But Ed, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Welcome back. I just want to tell you a little bit about the valley. Can you all hear me okay? A little bit about the valley of death. That's our topic today. And it's an interesting thing that when you talk to venture capitalists, we've begun to look at the valley of death as how you get out of an investment at the end successfully because of Sarbanes-Oxley and a lot of other factors, the efforts they're making to try and make stock options not as usual a motivating tool, and some other challenges that we've got in this country that we're trying to figure out in order so that venture capitalists can return money to their investors more successfully. But the valley we're here to talk about is an innovation stifling valley that's much closer to the beginning of the process. Are there any entrepreneurs in here? I know that Jim, who just introduced, okay, several of you, be sure and give us all your business cards before you leave. Maybe you're facing this challenge. If you've come up with a good idea, whether it's in nanotechnology or software or in other fields as well, and you want to, Nolan Bushnell said, I really like this, that good ideas are a dime a dozen. Everybody who's ever taken a shower has had a good idea. Well, to make them into businesses is a little harder, as you know, and one of the challenges is capital. So most people today max their credit cards and get money by the FBI method, friends, brothers, and in-laws, and use that money to get their company up to a certain point. Well, because of the difficulties that venture capitalists face on the other end, and because they can, venture capitalists are setting a higher standard these days than they did during the 90s of what an outcome looks like, and so therefore what a fundable company looks like. So you have to use this money, to your friends, brothers, and in-laws' money, or if you get lucky, angel money, to get to a certain state, usually either a revenue-producing state or a state where you can see revenue over the horizon pretty soon, and in fact have at least customers who will say, yes, this is a meritorious thing that you're doing. In nanotechnology, that's hard because in some cases what you're doing is actually scientists. And in fact, how many of you think of yourself as a scientist and an entrepreneur? Can I see a show of hands for that? Okay, got a number of hands for that, and a couple of you may be a little reluctant to put your hands up for that, but that's science. Sometimes the flash to bang time is longer. It takes, if you're really doing scientific research, R&D, investment comes in things that have had some emphasis on the D, not on the R. So we think this is an interesting challenge. How do you get across to that? People who've done angel investing have found that sometimes there have been some cram downs and other situations that make it difficult for them to be successful as the investment moves over into the institutional venture capitalists. But we think that there is some possibilities to cross this early valley of death, and this panel is going to tell you hopefully how to do it. Maybe we'll have some little controversy about how to do it. I know it was couched as a debate, but for a debate you need two different sides, and I think we'll come up with several. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce my first panelist, who's going to give us a little introduction to what his organization does and some thoughts about the valley of death. Steve Jurvetson, Managing Director of Draper Fisher Jurvetson. So thanks, Steve.
Thanks. Great. Thank you. Can you hear me okay? Well, it's great to be back. I probably won't open with many observations on the Valley of Death. I'll save that for the Q&A. I was by email asked to just quickly introduce myself and our firm, but I think Charlie Harris did that better than I ever could, and I want to thank him for that. I was here hearing his remarks and couldn't do better. So let me just give you a little background of why we love nanotech so much and what we're doing in the sector. And I'll use this slide as just a reminder to talk just briefly about myself and Foresight. My interest in this organization that's sponsoring the conference goes back at least 6 years with some intense focus and 20 years through some less intense focus, in that this is, I think, my sixth year in a row being at this event, and I've enjoyed it very much, and there are other Foresight events as well that I attend. But going back 20 years, I started off doing material science research. This was a photo I took using high-resolution transmission electron microscopy of some gallium arsenide atoms. Simple work, recrystallization from the amorphous to the crystalline state. Each dot there roughly is an atom. It opened my eyes about 20 years ago to the marvels of our ability to image the atomic scale world. We had very little and crude tools in terms of manipulation. We couldn't identify the species of individual atoms. We couldn't manipulate them in 3D. There's a lot of things we couldn't quite do back then, manipulating the Legos with boxing gloves, if you will, to use a crude analogy. And we've made a lot of progress in the last 20 years. But it did give me a sense of what was achievable in the lab at the time, and that was coupled with a fascination with the future. I took a class taught by Eric Drexler at Stanford in 1989, and it didn't quite couple to what I saw within the lab at the time, but I could see a bridge or a pathway between the capabilities we were developing, branching forward from the present, to the capabilities he saw branching back from the future. And so I think that's part of what makes Foresight Institute so interesting and this event so popular. Enough about me. Let me just briefly mention an update on where DFJ is. I think I've presented in some prior conferences, so many of you may already be familiar. I'll try to just give you the updates. We continue to expand our international network of affiliated funds. They all have cross-linked equity ownership in each other, so they operate like a federated network. And over the last 5 years, it's been increasingly growing internationally. I was just in China last week, checking out a variety of wafer fabs and other photonic fabs over there in Shenzhen. And we are in the process of opening new offices in Ukraine, Moscow, Australia, and a clean tech and energy fund based both on the East Coast and West Coast that brings a whole team of new people from Advent and a variety of other places to focus specifically on energy and clean tech applications, much of which, of course, will overlap deeply with materials and nanotechnology. So in aggregate now, we're a bit over $3 billion in capital under management and see this model scaling quite nicely in a horizontal sort of patchwork quilt across the country. So last slide. I just realized one of the things moved around a little bit, but it's readable. So this is a retrospective rationalization of the industry categories we've been investing in. And let me, again, for those who've seen it before, just highlight what's changed since last year. I think we've seen an increasing interest in energy, energy conversion applications in clean tech, and as it overlaps with nanotech. In general, there's about 27 or 28 tiny tech companies on the chart here, and more adding every week. The generalizations I made last year are still true in that the tools companies are the first to revenue. They're the ones that are coming actually close to profitability in some cases, and in almost all cases are on a revenue ramp. The molecular electronics companies are still in sort of advanced commercialization, working with wafer fabrication partners to produce, you know, megabit test chips, working with foundries and partnering like crazy, but not yet shipping in volume. And the sort of MEMS photonics category continues to do well, and luckily for them, China is rebounding as a customer set. So Huawei is becoming much more important to them than Cisco. And the new category that continues to be emerging are sort of our 10 to 20 year hypothesis for growth vectors on the biologically inspired vectors. So doing unusual things, re-engineering microbes, bacteria, viruses, you name it, everything from greenfield that uses an artificially evolved algae to eat NOx and SOx and produce biodiesel as its waste product, to my most recent investment. I've just joined the board of Synthetic Genomics, and this isn't yet announced, and I'll just end on this one anecdote because it's such an exciting company to me at the frontier of this brave new world in which re-engineering the information systems of biology gives you an interesting way to sort of build the future. What this company is doing is taking the combination of Craig Venter's research on the minimum genome, the simplest organism that can still self-reproduce, and his unusual trip sailing around the world, shotgun sequencing the seawater for all the millions of viruses and bacteria that exist out there. And in the last 12 months, for those who haven't tracked that project, he's grown the number of known genes on the planet tenfold through this one project, and the number of known genes associated with energy conversion 100-fold. So we knew about photosynthesis, purple algae, a variety of other things. The seawater has been evolving for a long period of time and has an enormous number of pathways heretofore unknown to science for energy conversion. What do I mean? Generating hydrogen from water, generating ethanol from biomass. And what he intends to combine now in this company with Ham Smith and the usual cohort of people that did Celera and the Human Genome Project, he's now looking at synthesizing, realizing that when you build a genome from scratch, you can do it now on an exponentially decreasing cost. Let's just digitally engineer life forms to do what we want instead of using, again, sort of a boxing glove biotech approach and lucky splices. So he's going to be trying to do some new energy applications at the frontier of the unknown in biology that we think will have some very interesting applications in energy and nanotech in the future. I see my sign is to end up. So that's enough about us and what we've been doing. Let me hand it over to the next person.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Next up is Floyd Kwame of Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers. Would you care to, you want, wish to stay seated?
That's fine. That's fine with you. That's fine. Okay. It was mentioned earlier that we were supposed to have a debate, and I was reading the instructions last night, and so I decided to take the position that there's no such thing as the valley of death. And I will defend that position today, okay? The important thing to recognize. Oh, and by the way, I'm not now any longer speaking with my government hat on. I'm my Kleiner Perkins hat on, but I'm Kleiner Perkins partner emeritus, which means you're old and no longer necessarily part of the partnership. Okay, so don't ascribe all this to KP if you wouldn't mind. Okay. The important thing, and Charlie touched on this in venture investing, we all get measured by IRR. And if you got a good IRR, you get an X fund. If you don't, you won't. And when you look at the equation for IRR, if an idea is a relatively small idea, you better have it liquid pretty quickly. And if it's a huge idea, you got some time. And that's what drives things. We use what we call the 10X rule. If you take a look at an awful lot of technology, it's improving about 20% per annum. It usually takes a couple of years to get something to market. That says that you've used up the fact that your competition is getting better at 20% per annum, so they're 50% better back at that point in time. And then the other thing that's happening is you've got to be at least twice as good as your competition by the time you get to market, and that's another factor too. So you got to get close to 10x better when you start the project from whatever is available in the marketplace. Earlier, it was asked how many of you consider yourself scientists and entrepreneurs, and there were some hands. I think the proper question is how many of you consider yourself salesmen and entrepreneurs, because you got to be a good salesman to get funding. It's just that simple. And so the valley of death, frankly, doesn't tend to happen to people who are good salesmen with a great idea. It's true that a lot of ideas don't get funded, but what happens to a great salesman is they go back and they change the equation around a little bit. And we certainly in our partnership have situations where the same team came to us and got funded on as late as the third shot because they had changed the message, they made it a better message. So I think that's an important thing to recognize, and there's lots of ways to get funded. The FBI approach is obviously one. But you shouldn't also assume that large firms don't do very, very nascent deals, because it's just plain not true. Our firm got involved in a very, very nascent deal several years ago that turned out pretty good. The name of the company was Google. There was two young guys that just thought they had an algorithm. I mean, it was pretty nascent, but it was a big, big idea. I'll end by saying in the nano field, and I'm really agreeing with what Steve's saying here, there are a lot of very, very big ideas happening in the energy sector that tie to nano right now, and they are very, very big ideas, and they will get funded. And so if you're tied into that, with energy being the issue it is today, I think there's a lot of opportunity. I think I'll finish with that.
Thank you, Floyd. Next up is Michael Most, Chairman and CEO of Think Equity Partners. Michael.
Good morning. Just by way of brief background, Think Equity Partners is a four-year-old plus firm that I co-founded with the idea that we were trying to create the preeminent growth investment bank focused on growth companies and growth investors. And the way that we felt we could accomplish that was identifying what we call the stars of tomorrow today, which are the fastest growing, most innovative companies in the marketplace. My background prior to starting Think Equity was I was head of global growth research at Merrill Lynch, which was a big title and dysfunctional job, and it was a dysfunctional job. But prior to that, I was head of growth research and strategy at Montgomery Securities. And really, we felt the opportunity with the demise of the growth investment banks was to fill the hole in the marketplace that existed to provide growth capital and research on innovative companies and dynamic entrepreneurs. Today, we have 180 people. We're in five offices. San Francisco's our headquarters. We've raised over $5 billion in 50 transactions for growth companies. Nanotechnology is an area that is of huge importance to us, primarily based on our firm's mission of being involved with the important ideas of tomorrow. In fact, we were very fortunate to be the lead underwriter for two transactions for Harris & Harris Corporation, which the most recent secondary we did was in August. But we really believe that this is going to be the decade of the mini-me. And when you're looking at the convergence that's going on in this world and the opportunities to create solutions to problems, energy being a great example, we can't think of an area that's more interesting or more exciting for the next 10 to 20 years than the nanotechnology space. Just the last piece in terms of what we believe is, you know, growth capital might be more challenging to get than perhaps it was in the heyday during the 1990s when a business plan that just came off the press could be funded. But I think as Floyd and Steve would attest, you know, companies that truly have what I call the four P's, great people, leading product with a claim to fame, huge potential, and predictability. And predictability, not, you know, necessarily revenues or anything like that, but milestones that can be pointed to that a company can achieve. And I think to Floyd's point, can sell that idea to the financial community. There's plenty of capital available. I mean, the market's back. You know, the investors are looking for innovation. They're starved for innovation, and they're looking for big ideas. So with that, I'm looking forward to the panel.
Good. Thank you, Michael. Ray Rothrock, Managing General Partner of Venrock Associates.
Okay. Ray. Let's go up here, if you don't mind. Start right there. So good morning. Thank you very much. Hi, Steve. How you doing? Good to see you. Let's see. I'm just going to go quickly a little bit about Venrock, a little bit about our view on nano and what it's all about. And for those of you who don't know much about Venrock, Venrock was formed in 1969 as an outgrowth of the Rockefeller Family Venture Capital Program, which was originally started in 1938 by Lawrence Rockefeller. So it's had a very long legacy of investing in hard-to-do engineering, hard science, and seminal products. Today, it's about a $1.4 billion under management. It's morphed from the Rockefeller family evergreen business into a traditional limited partner partnership. We have about 80% traditional LPs and 20% family. The portfolio today is 100 companies, 60% in information technology, 40% in life sciences. So we are a very broad portfolio. Our group is very technically rich in terms of our backgrounds and experiences. Lifetime, we've done about 360 companies since 1969, and 100 of those have gone public. So we tend to shoot for the home runs. That's where the best results are, and that's where the entrepreneurs, we believe, want to go. I don't know who said it at the FBI. Our little thing is FFF. That's friends, families, and fools, not... Just want to make that comment. So deal selection criteria, you know, for nano, since it's a very science-oriented deal, you really do need a world-class team. And you don't necessarily know that right from the beginning, but one of the barometers or telltales that you have when you're evaluating teams is, you know, people are known by the company they keep. So you see where they are, you see who they surround themselves with, you meet their spouse, you do all the things you can to sort of to come up with some sort of a qualification about the quality of the people. The second is the world-class science. That also is very hard to determine, but when you look at credentials, you look at peer review, you look at all the things that tell you about that science, you can come up with a factor. This also, I think, sometimes venture capitalists, the ones who really care about the science and the team and ultimately the products, are pretty good at identifying the world-class science. Hopefully someday it becomes Nobel class, but you rarely know that since you're investing generally in early science and it takes 20 or 30 years for that science to prove itself. Product market validation, sometimes this is where also the venture capital group provides a lot of vision because we generally track markets, we track conferences like this to see what people are interested in, and many times the science or the team is not necessarily in that particular space. I think really it's mentioned several times in different ways, but the path from the lab bench to the market or to the product, that's really critical. And a great scientist coupled with a great engineer can have a fantastic result. I think Intel was that exact formula of a great science and great engineering all at the same time. There's been many, many other companies. I think Google also fits that, you know, the search science with great engineering and performance. So there's many, many companies that fit that. Reasonable cash requirements, you know, try to keep it down to a minimum as you get older. And I'll tell you, gray hair on your board really helps a lot here because we've all been in situations where we were spending too much money. The other thing that Nano particularly provides, and I've seen this in many of the deals I've done, is where does the product fit in the value chain? Rarely does a Nano product result in an end product like a computer or a piece of software or something that a user will use. It's usually in a long value chain. So, for example, in the fuel cell business, there's lots of components in there. But the fuel cell value chain isn't very well developed. So you have to really kind of understand where it fits in that value chain. And then, of course, good science is hard to do, and it's very expensive, so you need to have partners identified. So what are the risks and downside? Well, you know, world-class teams often need to be assembled. That's like herding cats often. World-class science is really, really hard to do right. And you have to know that going in, so you've got to be prepared to have a few failures, be prepared to stump your toe and so forth. Engineers are generally involved, I think, earlier rather than later. It's my bias being an engineer, and Floyd brought this point of about the 10X. New technology into existing markets requires at least a 10X price performance improvement. That way you can get new economics, you can get good gross margins, and all the other things that are necessary to make a real business. So the 10X is really a minimum sort of thing you look for. Capital requirements typically are leveraged, and the concentration of customers. In some of these nano deals, you have a lot of concentration, which is a big risk, right? If your customer goes out of business or changes their mind or doesn't want to buy your product, you can be really hosed. So Venrock's done a lot of investments in small deals, if you will. Actually, the first one we did was a long time ago in 1984 with Kopin back east. This was a spin-out of MIT. But these are just some of the more recent ones. Caliper today is a $200 million public company, doing about $83 million in revenues. Illumina is a $600 million valued company with about $60 million in revenues. Surface Logics is still private, and they've taken some of their nano chemistry and have started to develop some biopharmaceuticals, which is very interesting stuff. NanoSys, you're probably all pretty familiar with that company. This here in the Bay Area, still private, has over 400 patents and has developed a lot of very interesting technology. My time is short. Nanogram Devices, which Charlie very much highlighted. This was an excellent deal. This is where we took something that people said couldn't be done. We built it in the lab, did some accelerated testing, and showed it to our competition, and they acquired the company. It was a very good example of how bulk materials change their properties at the nanoscale. And that's exactly what that company did. And quantum dots for future applications in circuits. The other thing that I completely agree with Steve on the point about nano for energy, it's a big deal. The one thing I'll leave you with is that at the end of the day, results matter. This is actually, results matter was actually a graduation commencement speech by the owner of the Dallas Cowboys when I was a kid. It was a two-word speech, results matter, and never forget that. So when you're out there doing your nano investing and so forth, you really have to keep that in mind. And as for the valley of death, I think that valley of death assumes that you're not going to make it. So I would encourage you to pick your camel, your partner, very carefully, sip your water, your money, set your compass, and go forth. That's it.
Great. Thanks, Rick. Pick your camel, sip your water, set your compass, and go forth. That's easy to remember. It works well. Thanks. So is this a real valley? I'm not sure that we're going to have much debate about that. Some of us have some questions about it. Steve, I'll start with you. Is it real, and you know, how does it impact companies, and how does it impact innovation?
Well, I think it's going to be tough to have a debate on this one because it's real for some and not real for others. And I think it's real for most. Mm-hmm. It mostly is the category of, I've got a technology and I'm not sure it's a business, who's going to fund me? I mean, if that's what we're talking about, I think there's a pretty big valley that needs to be crossed, so whether you can find a salesperson to join you, as was mentioned, or some other business person, maybe I would generalize to, that can help you bridge that gap, it can be a very real valley. And what I mean by real is, there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there, I would suspect at least 80% of the entrepreneurs in this room, who have not had an easy time finding a funding source. That's the sense I get. And the reason is, it's very difficult for a lot of investors to understand the category. If you've been doing software investing for 20 years, this isn't just an obvious hop, skip, and jump over from what you've done before. If you're a semiconductor investor, you've probably done it for a number of years and you've been successful in that category, and there's some biases that that brings to the table. It was much like the internet in 1985, 86, and 87. Do you come at it with a media perspective, a consumer software perspective, a gaming perspective? Which metaphor or business lessons learned, if you would, should you apply to this new category? And almost anyone who tried didn't invest in the category, meaning if you saw shrink wrap software, you would have avoided the internet. If you saw hits-driven businesses, you would have said, the internet's no different. I'll just pass, thank you. And I think you see a lot of that coming from traditional sectors in the venture community as well. If it's a new industry, it doesn't necessarily have a huge following until someone's proven that it's an obviously good idea. And that comes later. So it's great for new entrants. These new venture funds that are focused on nanotech, just like they were new entrants and firms that made a great name for themselves in the early days of the internet, someone who's willing to stake a claim. So I think it's up to entrepreneurs to find them. The friends, families, FBI, however you want to, Triple F or FBI, however you want to look at it, is likely to be the most likely funding source for some. Although I would say in the nanotech sector, when I mean for some, I mean in general, startups that have this gap between mainstream funding sources and where they are when they start. Nanotech has a unique issue and opportunity. The issue is it's tough to tinker around in your garage with a transmission electron microscope. It's just the equipment and tooling doesn't lend itself for the typical home inventor. And so for those in a university environment, those in a government lab, there are unique opportunities for you for government funding and sources. Battelle, Aerospace Corporation and Girvan, there's a number of organizations that can actually work with you to understand the commercialization process and have a great track record doing that and connecting to venture firms down the way. But if you're not in one of those institutions, I think there's a different answer in your ability to get government grants to, in a sense, distinguish yourself from, a research phase from a commercialization phase. And I think the investors at the table are looking for companies that are in formation, business opportunities, people that can talk about who their customer is going to be as opposed to what the tech innovation is. And so the thing we struggle with is, how do we differentiate something that really should take another round of government grants versus something that's ready for prime time and commercialization? And so in a rambling way, I believe the value exists. I think it typically, for our nanotech portfolio, has been largely government funded to the point at which we then engage. And even more so than, FBI maybe in the most literal sense, a government agency of some sort has stepped in like over 90% of our nanotech startups.
Okay. All right, thanks, Steve. Floyd, what should the role of government be in helping startups get going?
Well, as I said in my remarks on the NNI, the obviously basic research has increasingly become a government function. I mean, when you look back 40 or 50 years, when there were the Bell Labs and the size of the Xerox parks and the Fairchild R&D, where I got started in 1963, those have largely gone into the government sector with support at universities. And I would completely agree with what Steve just said. The research that has come out of these university programs particularly has been extremely valuable. When I look at the KP portfolio in biotechnology, for example, I can't think of one that didn't start out of a university project. I just can't think of one. And a company would be formed, and frequently the day we funded the company, it had zero employees because the people stayed in the university, and one of the partners became the CEO of this entity, but then it funded, the entity then funded the research to go further within the university environment, which is a model that I think might be applicable and maybe similar to what Steve's talking about. In some of what they've done, I'm not fully familiar, of course, with what he's saying, and I think the university environment is just an extremely important one to keep in mind. I mean, I like to say that the biotech industry, the semiconductor industry, the software industry, the internet industry, the PC industry, in large, they all have one thing in common: they were all started by people in their 20s. And those are generally people in universities. And so disruptive ideas tend to come out of there. And that's why I also believe that energy is such an opportunity, because Lee Raymond and ExxonMobil are not going to solve the energy problem in this country. They're just not going to, okay? It'll be the 20-year-olds that have the new exciting ideas. And so you got to stay close to that. And I think from an investor's point of view, they're looking for that. They're looking for the bright young person who doesn't know what can't be done.
That's right.
Good. All right. Thanks. That's very helpful. Michael, I'm sure that you look at a number of deals in various stages. What one of the things that I've seen in nanotechnology deals is that often they're what Steve said earlier, where it's a technology kind of in search of a problem. But sometimes what you see is a technology that has two or three clear applications that look like opportunities. And the entrepreneur says, well, I can do two or three. Can a startup do more than one application, or are you looking for one that's just going to do one well?
That's a tough question, because every company is different. I mean, I think what you like to see is, you know, technology where you can have a clear path to what the problem it's solving is. You know, in some cases, like a NanoSys, where they have 400 patents, you know, you're betting on some very smart people where there's great partners, and you can see, you know, it's almost a portfolio approach, if you will. You can see the opportunity is almost endless, and that through smart people and opportunity and these partners, there's going to be a prioritization where you're going to apply it. So I don't think there's a simple answer to that question. It really depends on the specific situation. I think as you look to see what, in fact, you know, I think is part of the valley of death, isn't so much that the venture capital community isn't looking to fund innovation and big ideas, and whether it be a specific application or broad applications. I think it's as you look ahead, because, you know, I think the venture capital community is playing offense again. It's playing offense after 3 years of trying to nurse the ones that were still alive to some type of health. But it's really looking at what the exit is. And I think to Floyd's point, unless it's a really big idea, you know, the time frame has to be relatively short. And the traditional exit opportunity or monetization event, being the IPO market, has been significantly different than it has been, you know, over the 10 years prior. And so that's an issue that needs to be kind of worked through. And again, the great thing about the capital markets is it reinvents itself all the time, trying to find solutions to these problems. And I guess now I'm not answering your question at all, but the fact of the matter is, actually, we're quite optimistic about, you know, that environment for the right kind of companies with the right kind of opportunity.
Ed, could I make a comment on that?
Please do.
I don't know how many of you remember the early days of the laser industry. Here was this fantastic phenomena, and everybody was making better and better and better in lasers, but nobody was selling anything. And so you had companies like Coherent Radiation, or now called Coherent. And I remember touring there in about 1972, and they were doing everything from drilling precision holes for people to doing eye examinations, and I don't know what all else. And they had a couple of million dollars in revenue. I mean, it was almost nothing. And so they had a real valley of death problem keeping the thing going, because they were trying to do so many things. And then came barcode readers in grocery stores. And the laser industry took off like a rocket ride. And people start, and with that, the cost of lasers came down, the value of lasers. And now, I mean, just think of all the things that involve a laser today. I think there's a similarity, you may not see it right now, in a number of things we're learning about from nanotechnology. There's a lot of very fundamental things that we're starting to learn to know, and Steve's firm knows probably better than anyone of us, certainly than I do, up here. And something, you know, I don't know who said this, but I think I might slightly disagree. There'll be a breakout. There'll be a barcode scanner someplace. I bet my bottom dollar on it. I've been in this valley for going on, 46 years now, and I know there's going to be a breakout. I cannot tell you where it's going to be necessarily, but so that science was very important in the laser area, But until you had the breakout, until you had your eyes open, and who would have guessed when lasers started that the breakout would be checking things out of grocery stores? I mean, that wasn't obvious. But that's what happened. And it launched an industry. So you got to be sensitive on both sides. And that does not say that you need a huge marketing department and a huge sales department. All this. You don't need any of that kind of stuff, usually. You need an idea and wide set of ideas. And like I say, be young enough to not get discouraged.
So it's the application.
The application is going to be important. Okay. In all of this stuff, and it might not come anywhere. All kinds of examples exist in this business. How many people here know that Rome was started to build military computers? Yeah, I mean, it wasn't started to do what it ended up doing, but they saw an opportunity. You know, I think if you put the blinders on, if you're an entrepreneur, you gotta focus, but you also gotta know what's going on outside, or you'll miss the big deal. Rome became a very, very successful company in an area that they did not found the company to do.
You got to be willing to steer the car
and make a turn. Yeah. Yeah, and then focus. And you got to focus on what you're focusing on. But if you're blinding yourself and you're not ready to make quick turns, or you're so sold on where the application should be that you're letting something else run by you, that's a huge mistake.
Ray, I know that we're all shooting for huge home runs whenever possible, but can you describe a situation where a company might come to you with something that where the outcome would be to get acquired, and is that a reasonable proposition to bring to a venture capitalist, or is it always best case IPO?
It is not something we start down a path to be acquired. Mm-hmm. We usually always want to back people who want a public offering, who are shooting for the stars. I think it's human nature that if you set your goal here, you might get there. But if you set your goal here, you will never get there. And this is the IPO, and this is the acquisition. And invariably, you need a market for that to occur, and sometimes creating that market is very expensive. And at the end of the day, the outcomes, you can argue with the value, and therefore you argue with the outcomes, and therefore you're sitting around the table sort of figuring out what to do with the proceeds. And it can make for a fine outcome, but not the smoothest, prettiest, and best for the entrepreneur, for the shareholders, for the investors. You know, I say that I don't mean just that that's the only way, but we always like to do deals that have IPO potential. You want to do big deals. That's what makes a reputation of a venture capital firm. It's what keeps you in business, what keeps your limited partners sending you dollars every year. So that's really, really the point. I just want to pick up on one point a while ago. Floyd, said about the young people finding things. You're really, really absolutely right on that. In fact, someone did a study. The Nobel Prizes in the sciences occurred 30 years after the scientists did it. And those scientists, 90% of them were under the age of 30. And so it takes a long time for that science to be revealed for what it is. But it is that innovation. It's that entrepreneur, no mountain is too high, no valley is too long to get over it. I was just last week at the MIT Nuclear Engineering Visiting Committee, and they are looking at nano things in the nuclear engineering field. And it's really quite remarkable what some of these young PhD junior professors are considering. I mean, it's really off the scale. So it's very exciting.
People who don't believe they can fail.
But yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good. We'd like to take some questions from the floor. I think there may be someone who's got a microphone to... Oh, good, yes. So we have one back there. I see a hand. I think that's the first hand I saw go up. I ask you all to keep your question brief and clear, and if you have a preference as to who you'd like to have answer it, you may state it.
Actually, I have two questions, but I'll try to make them brief. I'm from a federal research lab, so I don't get to play in your world all that often, but one question is, for you to make a decision on investing, obviously you want to have certain margins and profitability in 10x. How much do you lean on having the opportunities leverage off of the economics associated with globalization and using the low cost of offshoring? And also, what are your thoughts on the trends towards offshoring of innovation, and how can we keep the United States competitive in that manner?
Okay.
I'll take a crack at that. The notion of being global has been fundamental in the tech industry since its inception, really, in the 50s. I mean, Fairchild Semiconductor put a plant in Hong Kong in 1959. That's a long time ago. In the software business, in most tech businesses, you better think globally or you're going to get your head handed to you by somebody else. So the notion of being a global company from a marketing, sales, projection point of view is very, very important. Now, there are exceptions. Obviously, if you're a service-oriented business, you might be quite regional or something like that. But if you have an exciting new software product or whatever, having said that, when you start looking at the cost of your product, it's true that in the United States, there's only been, one new large-volume semiconductor fab in the last, 20 years. Maybe it's two new fabs, and there have been about 20 in China alone, or China and Southeast Asia. So you end up going most semiconductor startups have been fabless. I think the last public one was Cypress Semiconductor that had its own fabs. So you end up having to use sources that are available to you, and that's just a matter of being competitive. Now, sometimes these help you in your international marketing efforts. Having plants throughout Southeast Asia, like we had in the early days of National, were very, very helpful in us getting projects or business out there. You have to watch your intellectual property. Your intellectual property in many startups is your most precious ingredient. And many people then, therefore, don't go to certain areas because they are afraid of losing their intellectual property. And there are a number of examples where people have paid a pretty heavy price for that and probably made the right decision to maintain that. So lots of considerations, but you better be thinking globally at launch or at least in our firm, that wouldn't be well regarded.
We put every company that we look to work with in a framework. The first question is, what problem does the company solve? But then we look at megatrends that we think are important to affect how big an opportunity is. Globalization is at the very top of that megatrend framework that we evaluate. Outsourcing, demographics, convergence, the internet, ROI, what type of ROI are you creating? That's a framework that we use in globalization. As I said, there's nothing that's more fundamental.
I'll add two comments. One, every great company, I've been in the tech business since the 70s and in venture capital since the early 80s, so every great company I'm aware of went global fast. I mean, right out of the gate, either with sales or something or manufacturing. And the other thing that I've observed recently is that money will follow productivity. So the capital's going to flow, so you might as well follow it. It's just going to go where it can have the best return.
Good. I want to stop us at this point for another question. So is it up here? He'll be right there.
Ray made an interesting comment. He thought the engineer has to be involved. And I wanted the panel to expand on that. I represent the IEEE Nanotechnology Council of the Bay Area. And we believe a lot of money has been spent over the last 10 years into research. And if you want to commercialize, make something out of it, then the engineering community has to get involved. Could you please comment?
Steve, you want to take that one?
Gosh, yeah. I mean, it's hard to... I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm trying to remember the original context of the statement. We absolutely want to hear from the engineers. So in pitch meetings, we try actually not to hear from the salespeople. even though the engineer needs to be a salesperson, they tend to... it tends to be the engineer or the innovation that we focus on to start and then figure out the market to follow. So, I'm not sure how to respond. Maybe I'll just be short in saying that in most of the interesting companies, you find a dynamic duo. Some engineer who has the key innovation coupled with someone who understands the customer and can bridge the communications gap that sometimes exists between them. Think about Jobs and Wozniak. There's one very forward-looking person, but someone behind the scenes who did all the work, right? Gary Ellison, Bob Miner. you know, Gates and, you know, Paul Allen. It just goes on and on and on. There's usually a pairing. Hotmail had a pair. Google has a pair. It just goes on and on. Skype, same thing. And so, you know, the engineer can be a little bit more quiet at times and isn't speaking at conferences and may have a lower public persona. By the time the company's become successful, usually by that point, the salesperson is the mic and the spotlights and center stage. But at the point where folks here on the panel are speaking to a company, I mean, we're always having deep communications with the engineers, much more so, and with marketeers, and less so with, you know, others, if you will. I don't know if that spoke to your question, though.
Did that answer the question? Versus, or was it more versus scientists?
No, more versus as it relates to nanotechnology.
Okay.
But what in particular are you curious? Is it that does an organization of engineers need to come into play, or is the engineer the hero? I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, if I could just, but yeah, I think it's a great point. I put it in quotes because engineer, I sort of think of that. My view is there's DNA that builds things and there's DNA that discovers things. And that's sort of the differentiation I was trying to make.
But we are just about out of time. And by way of wrap up, obviously, I really like the pick your camel, sip your water, and so forth. It's also the advice seems to be, watch your intellectual property, as you go global, move towards an IPO with a big idea, and work with people who don't believe they can fail, some of whom are often young, but at least young in that sense. Great products with big potential, big ideas, predictability in terms of both how you spend your money and how you achieve your results. And last of all, but not least, it's the application, not the science, that makes it into a business. So thank you very much.
Great.
I'm told I have two more minutes. My watch must be fast. Would you like me to take one more question then, Jim? Okay, we can take one more question, I'm told. Okay, right there. Yes, go ahead.
Hey, TEDx is a pretty high threshold. I'm wondering, and this is to anybody on the panel who wants to comment, what's the path for, as you know, new technical improvements, you know, they come with a general distribution, right? They'll be anywhere from 1x all the way up to whatever the maximum is, given the technical feasibility. What is the path of adoption for 2x and 5x technical improvements? Would that just stay in an existing company, or sort of how would those guys get picked up? Because, you know, there may be lots of researchers who have a 5x idea. It's not enough to do an IPO. What can we do?
Michael, you want to take that one? And if you could, start by saying what you mean by 10x. Is it 10x? I'll let you leave.
Well, no, I think maybe.
Sure. You know, it comes from the old computer business, the speeds and feeds. So if your processor, your cost, if the ratio between the old generation and the new generation is more than 10x, that's the sort of genesis of that. It also has a dimension of Moore's Law, which also fits there. I'd say the 5x guys, those projects won't survive. It won't be good for the corporation in which it lives. It won't be sufficient enough to get critical mass on the outside and get separately financed. So it is all about moving the bar in step functions. And, you know, I think Steve, integrated circuits was like 1,000x when Noyce did that. I mean, it's, you know.
I don't want to end on a discouraging note, but 10x is barely interesting. 10x in terms of product performance and 10x in terms of economic return, both concepts of that, in that if you don't have 100x headroom that will get shrunk to 10x by the time you ship,
yeah,
right, given your hiccups and starts and you don't have the learning curve benefits, and try to compete with the disk drive industry, the chip industry, or any of these types of companies. So see what I mean? It doesn't mean there isn't room for that innovation. Large companies tend to make sustaining innovations, per Clayton Christensen. The startups that we're all looking for want to change the world. It's the fundamental mantra that drives them. It's why they shoot for an IPO rather than M&A. They don't even think about M&A. They want to make a big impact on the world. And if an acquisition comes, that's just great. For our venture funds, making 10x return is barely interesting. Probably for the funds that had Google in it, you know, a 10x you wouldn't even notice it, because a 1,000x return swamps it. And so we always look for how big can the winners become? Can they shoot for the prize? Can they make a lasting impact in the world? And by the way, that's really not all that there is out there in the economy. So, you know, take with a grain of salt that this has been a venture tilted panel. You know, the friends and families, 3 to 5x is great. You know, there's a lot of people, a lot of places in the economy where that's nothing to go home upset about if you tripled your money or something. Whereas in the venture business, tripling your money and losing it all are totally bad outcomes.
Thanks, Steve. I ask that you all keep your seats for just a moment. Let's thank our panelists, Steve Jurvetson, Floyd Kwame, Michael Moe.